Oh, it felt good to sing that song, especially having prepared a message from Psalm 46, from whence that song was conceived and written by Martin Luther. So take your Bible and turn with me to a psalm that the Lord laid upon my heart to preach on the Sunday before this election. That particular song, like I said, was the scriptural this is the scriptural basis for that song, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. Martin Luther was a teacher, as you know, a teaching monk, and he taught for years the book of Psalms, and Psalm 46 was his favorite. There would be times when the darkness of the problems of this world would come in upon him, and he would cry out to Philip Melanchthon and say, "Come, let's sing the 46th. And they would sing that. It is reported, as I read a section, I want to say it was in the series of Psalms by Charles Haddon Spurgeon, that I don't know if it's Spurgeon who was quoting this, another man wrote it, but the account is told how that on the road, even on the way to the Diet of Worms, and where he gave that speech that I quoted this morning, Revoco, Revoco, and so forth, that he sang this song. It was had already been written, but he sang this song, that song we just completed, though this world with devils filled, and so forth. And when we come to this passage, and I don't know that I'm going to have time tonight to actually point out all of the places that that song, where it comes out, but the one where that one stands, I think it's second or third, I think it's the second, where it talks about the Lord Sabaoth. I always had thought about that was Lord Sabbath. That's not what it says, Lord Sabaoth. And it is actually in the psalm as it concludes, as part of the concluding thing, when it says in verse 11, "The Lord of hosts is with us." That is Lord Sabaoth. And it was very influential in that. And maybe I'll make reference to some more things when we come to that passage. But this particular psalm, I think, and has been used over the years, not only by Martin Luther, but to many others, as a psalm of solace and of refuge in God during difficult times. The historical account, we do not know specifically. Many believe it was after that there were some nations that had been taunting Israel, and after there was a battle and Israel had won. And this is what the psalm writer wrote as they would sing this important concept that God is our refuge. The Lutheran Hebrew scholar Leupold said about this psalm, "Few psalms breathe the spirit of sturdy confidence in the Lord in the midst of very real dangers as strongly as this one." So it's a good psalm for us to come to tonight as we hear upon reflection over the news and so forth, where as we take the vote on Tuesday, and then we don't know when we're going to find out who is actually going to be the new president. Probably, I think, unless it is an obvious landslide and unless someone decides to budge and concede, which I don't know that that'll happen or not. You know, there's a lot of unknowns about all of this that we may not know until Friday, Saturday, or January. We don't know. But there's obviously, like no other election in the 200 plus years of the United States, has there been so much turmoil and so much polarization. Now, that a lot of that has to do with policies and that kind of thing, but I think it really results from the turmoil that Satan is doing and bringing against our country. And it's not just against our country, that it is against the people of God. And there's a polarization. Last week, I think I made mention of the fact of a bit of the confrontation between Pastor John MacArthur at Grace Community Church and Pastor, I think retired Pastor John Piper at Bethlehem up in Ohio. I think that's where Minnesota, that's right. That he, you know, that these men good men, men that we would be in basic agreement with, and yet they disagree. Then there, the most recent one that came out is where Brother Wayne Grudem. Grudem has written a very big and extremely helpful systematic theology, and who is very close personal friends and is oftentimes seated on the same platform as John Piper, that he wrote a response, a very lengthy response, even when they warn you that it's going to take you 12 minutes to read. That's probably for fast readers. And then all those silly, don't you just hate all those advertisements? Ugh. But all those advertisements and that, but you go through and you read this, and it was a well-written response in disagreement. And John Piper is a very gracious man, and it did show two brethren that could graciously disagree on some of those things. And so the turmoil and all of that. But then as we watch the news and as we hear reports of businesses that are boarding up in anticipation of, and I made reference to this morning, in anticipation of rioting because they aren't going to like the results. My brethren, what on earth has this world come to? Now, in the midst of all of that, and not trying to become political or to rest in all of that, in a real sense, we need to fix our gaze upon God in the midst of all of this turmoil and to consider what saith the Lord. What does the Bible say? And where can we get some solace? I don't know about you, but I found some solace in just the songs we sung tonight. And then that one about the perfect wisdom of our God, that ought to encourage you as well. Psalm 46 is a psalm where we can come. And so tonight what I want to do is I just want to spend a little bit of time and to consider the threefold division of Psalm 46, as it is basically a psalm about how God is the refuge for his people. And it does have a national or governmental reflection. It is also true that there is a future aspect as it looks forward, a sense of reconciliation that we need to be mindful of. That there is a God in heaven who will reconcile all of this. And that we believe that, I mean, our theology teaches and our eschatology is things in this life will eventually get worse and worse and worse. And Jesus comes. We are of the persuasion, being biblical interpreters, that there is a future for Israel that doesn't come without a cost. And we have heard that preached for years and years. We just maybe didn't think seriously enough to think that we might be actually part of that generation. Now, I am not declaring that we are that generation, but it does it's beginning to look pretty good. That things are accelerating at an unbelievable rate. But just how and when and the details. That's why that song, a mighty fortress is our God. God is our refuge. And the Lord Sabaoth, he is the God of the host of heaven. Let's not forget who it is that we serve. And let's not forget there are casualties in the battle for truth. That has always been true throughout all of church history. We may be called upon to be part of some of those casualties. Now, I don't know, and I'm not a prophet, not the son of a prophet, but I don't know to what degree what I mean by casualties. But are you willing, for truth's sake, for Jesus' sake, to seal your faith with your life's blood? We may be called upon to do that. And in the words of the Apostle Paul, where he said, I bear in my body the brand marks of Christ, we may be called upon to do that. We may have a different structure within our church with respect to how we can worship and how the government gives us freedoms and what they will call upon us that we must do with respect to recognizing godless practices as far as what we offer employees. and the like, as what we saw previous administration do with the Little Sisters of the Roman Catholicism. And to go against moral conscience, which goes against the founding of our country. But again, we need to understand who and what we are, and that we must obey God rather than man. And then in the sense of our own constitution, we believe some things are God-given rights and are not rights given to us by the government. Well, when we come to this psalm, I think we'll find a sense of encouragement. Now, just by way of introduction, there's some things that we need, accounting work, as it were, or some detail work that we need to look at as we would begin. You notice that the Psalms, not all of them, but many of them have a superscript. And in the original text, that is there. Actually, that's verse 1. And we enumerate differently in our English text, and we keep that separate. But this becomes a part of the text. And so I want us just to look at that very briefly. It's kind of an interesting thing. Notice that it says, to the chief musician. So just right up front, this was something that Israel would sing. This was something that they found, and that's why it's kind of cool that A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, a song that we just sang. That there was a song that the nation would sing. And it was sung for several reasons. Number one is it was another aid or another kind of aid, like some psalms and like Proverbs 31 that is alphabetic. They did these things to help in memory. And some of these songs or psalms that they created to help in memory. It's kind of like, you know, you may not remember some words of a song, but once you start singing it, all of a sudden they flow together. We call that industry karaoke, I think. Although sometimes they do show you the words. It's kind of interesting. I like to get with Larry Madrid and with Tom and Stephen McNally and the like, and we talk about songs and what the words mean and how they come together, and it's just a fun thing. But when it's a song, you tend to put things together and remember them. So this was, as it says here, to the chief musician, a song. But that's what it says, of the a psalm of the sons of Korah. And they were basically the ones who would sing in the choir there and worship. But then we have this other cute, I'm going to say cute, this little phrase. It says, a song or psalm for Alamoth. Now, what is that all about? Well, the term Alamoth has been translated in two very different ways. And it is really quite interesting throughout church history to find out how people come to that. And it's interesting because of the people that fall on different sides of it. The majority of the people that come to the term Alamoth, they would refer to the fact that that can refer to a young virgin or to the young maidens. So, in other words, this was a song for Israel to be sung publicly, but by the sopranos. Okay, and that's where most of the people go. It was for the higher pitched people. It was, there was supposed to be a sense. Now, when you do that, I guess my problem with that, and yet that's where the bulk of the people come, that I'm not convinced that some of these things, like when it talks about a very present help in trouble, when it goes on, and the earth be removed, and the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though its waters roar and be troubled. I think, you know, to have that high, I just don't know that that fits. But who am I to question some great men? But what's interesting is that in the 1800s, there was a writer by the name of Plummer, wrote a really big volume on the Book of Psalms, and it is a wonderful book and has great things in it. And he follows another line. James Montgomery Boyce and others will mention this, but they don't necessarily fall into it. But the term Alamoth can refer to a word that means hidden things. Now, personally, I kind of like that, because I view the fact that God is hidden, God is unknowable, or rather incomprehensible, and only knowable as He has revealed them to us. And so the wicked, for example, and those who know not God nor believe in Him, they have a problem when we talk about in God is our refuge. They can't connect that, because what we understand is He's a refuge by faith. I trust Him with my future, my life. I find my rest in Him. They have no concept of that, because a refuge has got to be a building. A mighty fortress is our God, but He's not a building that we go into. He can be a fortress to the believers in California or in Georgia or in North Carolina, that we find ourselves and our rest in Him, because He has revealed Himself to us, and the hidden things of God are given unto His people. And this psalm is going to talk to us about to find our rest in Him, our refuge in Him. And that's a hidden thing from the world. So I kind of like that one, but it doesn't make or break the whole thing. And it's the introduction to the psalm. So maybe it's about the hidden things. And one of the hidden things is that women are supposed to sing this song. I don't know. I'll just leave it there. Now, let's come on and look at this threefold division. And when we look at this, it isn't the fanciful homiletics of the pastor that there's 3 points, but it divides itself into 3 stanzas. And we know that because of the use of the word Selah at the end of verse 3. Though its waters that be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling, Selah. Then we have the second one that is found at verse 7. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge, Selah. And then verse 11, as we conclude the psalm, the Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge, Selah. Now, that word Selah, it is a word it's actually the Hebrew word. It bids that the person to, I've always kind of contemplated it this way in my ministry, stop, wait, hesitate. And meditate. It's the idea that, okay, we've come here, stop and review that, digest it. Now, I'm a biologist, and I am so sorry that I have abused you over 26 years with very few sports illustrations, for which you have plenty of ammunition against me. And I use many biological and scientific illustrations. And the one is that the term Selah is like when a cow regurgitates its food. You know, they've got the 4 stomachs, and then, you know, they eat the grass, and then they chew it, and then they swallow, and then they bring it back up, and they chew on it some more and everything, and then they swallow it, and, you know, the gastric juices and everything. I just love this. And then you bring it up again, and then you do that again. Now, that's what Selah means. He said, okay, now you read through it. Well, that's nice. Stop. Swallow. And it's going to come back again. And you can take, and you need to stop, wait, hesitate, and meditate on the truth of this passage. Now, what's kind of cool about this one is that at each one of those Selahs, there is a major shift. And I would say a new direction, but a major shift. And so you can see that the term Selah, those are well placed. There was a poem that was given like this. Selah bids the music rest, pause in silence, soft and blessed. Selah bids uplift the strain, harps and voices to tune again. I guess it's more the English way, again. That's why they get that to rhyme. Selah ends the vocal praise, still your heart to God upraise. And so the term Selah, while it doesn't mean much in our kind of a culture, yet it is very much important for us to understand. And a lot of times in the Psalms, it gives us the structure of the Psalm for us to consider. So we have the threefold division of Psalm 46. Let's take a look at it. The first section is found in the first three verses. And in this, it is a reference to an immovable refuge. How that God is an immovable refuge, or we might say, a mighty fortress. As the structure as it comes, and in each three of these sections we have it, and that is that there is a theological declaration that comes right at the very beginning. One man put it this way, Psalm 46 is abrupt in its opening, exalted in its beginning. Notice, I mean, just out of it, okay, we're supposed to have women sing this thing. It's about the hidden things of God. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Now, that sets the tune, the tone, and the whole thesis of the entire psalm. It's going to go on, and we will see it at the break of the second section. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. And then as he concludes, you know, Jehovah Sabaoth is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Now, that implies something. One, that we have a need for refuge. We have a need to be protected. We have a need to have our quiet place. We have a need to be able to have a place of solace where we can go for protection. And we as the people of God, as what the nation of Israel was, that we need to understand and know that in the times of turmoil, when you look at your life falling apart, whether it be due to personal issues or it be to a national event, and we're all sitting at home with our concealed weapons and all this stuff ready, wondering, are they going to come for my guns? Are they going to come and try and root here? I'm not trying to instill a lot of fear here because I don't think that's going to happen. But anyway, so the idea of in the times of fear, I have a place where I can go and find solace. That's what he's going to mention here in a minute. But in the declaration, God is our place of refuge. We can go to him for protection. But notice that's not the only thing. It's the theological declaration that God is our refuge. But there is a second side to that. God is also our strength. And he then explains that in the second phrase, a very present help in trouble. When we find ourselves in the turmoil of life, we can go unto God for protection, for solace, for hiding, as it were, and in a mighty fortress. But we also need strength to get through the time of turmoil. He is making an assumption that turmoil exists. Now, let's place this into a historical account, not in our context, but in Martin Luther. What God was doing in that man's life, I mean, he didn't have someone to follow. Oh, yeah, there was Whitfield and others that that were around, and there were some other things, but he was kind of a pioneer, and he needed strength with the historical account of the power and the majesty, as it were, of the Roman Catholic Church. He needed strength to be able to say, you know, here I stand, God help me. I can do nothing else. The idea is he needed a God that would strengthen him, but also to protect him. And he found that in the theological statement of the verse 1. But then on verse 2 and 3, in the second half of this first division, that God is a mighty fortress and immovable refuge. And that's the theological result. We not only have the theological declaration, but the theological result found in verses 2 and 3. And the first one is, no fear. He says, therefore, conclusion, we will not fear. Now, when you do that, oftentimes, I don't know about you, but oftentimes I'm still fearing. And I'm still afraid. Oftentimes, it's not so much in the end result that I'm fearful of. I'm more fearful of the process. I'm not afraid of what's going to happen to me when I die. I have the faith in the promises of God, absent from the body, present with the Lord. I fear the pain in getting me to that point. I fear just, this may sound funny, theological profoundness here. I've never died before, and neither have you. And sometimes we have that, we almost feel like substandard Christians. I know I'm not to be afraid, but yeah, I'm kind of afraid to die. Evaluate that. Are you afraid of the process or the end result? If you're afraid of the end result, you need to come and talk. The process, I'll just give you a hug and say, so am I. I don't know, because we don't know, because that's what fear is fear is the unknown. I don't know how I'm going to die. I don't know if it hurts to leave my body. I know what's going to happen, and I'm not fearful over the what is going to happen to the real me and all that. But I do kind of wonder what that's kind of like. So in the sense that God is our refuge. Look, I don't know how the election is going to turn out. It depends upon what channel you're watching. And I don't think that they know. I think we're going to have to wait and see. And then I'm not so sure that people are going to really believe when we wait and see. And then what's going to happen after? You know what? I don't know. But this one thing I do know. God is my refuge. He is my strength. And in Him I will put my trust. And so He is my refuge. And the result is, I'm not really fearful over the other side, whoever wins. Because, ultimately, if you listen to some of the political argumentation, they're all trying to say, well, the United States won't be the same. No, it's not going to be the same. Would you expect it to be the same after all of this? No, it's not going to be the same. And there's fear mongering on both sides. There's, and all of that. But this one thing I know, Jesus Christ is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. He's going to be the same yesterday, today, and forever. And that it's in Him I put my trust, and it's in Him I find my refuge, and I will rest in Him. I'm not going to get so blown out of shape that I'm going to ruin my witness, my opportunity of serving others, and to do what God asked me to do as a Christian. And whoever is elected to that degree, he is my president. And to deny that, you just can't go do that. So we have now that God is our mighty fortress, and a result is no fear. But then he illustrates that no fear after. Therefore, we will not fear, even though, and these are some interesting things that in poetic language are very, very poetic and very good to contemplate. Even though the earth be removed. Now, that's the word removed. Would refer to, in a sense, what we would call, even though the earth have an earthquake, not an earthquake over in, some other place. And we've had some this week, and we know that earthquakes is a sign of the end times and that kind of stuff. But this one, even though the entire earth be shaking, my refuge, my place of safety is in God. Even though the earth be removed. One man put it this way, and some even translate it this way. Even though the earth becomes upside down. That concept is kind of interesting when it talks about the early New Testament churches. They would go out and preach. And that those that have turned the world upside down have come here. And so it is our job to turn the world right side up. As long as we can. And the freedoms and what it costs us to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. So, how, in what degree and how far do we find refuge with God? Though the entire world goes upside down and is shaken and a gigantic earthquake. So the illustration of that. And though the mountains be carried away into the midst of the sea. There was the references, if I'm not mistaken, in the Mighty Fortress is Our God, and talks about this sort of thing. That it's the idea that mountains were always a picture of something majestic. And again, profound theological truth here. Mountains are big. Mountains are just big. And so having the faith to move a mountain just is used in a poetic phrase, not to go around and that we're excavators, but it's the idea of a poetic way of saying My faith is to be that strong, that majestic, that powerful, that it could even move something that is that stuck into one position. Though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea. The devastation. Now, we understand from the book of Revelation, some bad things are going to happen in the world. But our God is our place of refuge, even if all the mountains go away. And then verse 3, we have a tsunami. Though its waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling. And the idea that the tsunami is so big that it comes and it causes the shaking of the mountains. In the midst of that kind of turmoil. Now, I'm sure that the Democrats would say that's what the Republicans are doing. And the Republicans will say that's what the Democrats are going to do. And what I'm saying is, whatever happens, guess what? God is to be our refuge. We have a reference point. God is our reference point. God is our place of solace. God is our place that we go to find our refuge. He is our safe place. He's the one in whom we can trust. He's doing His will. And by the way, He's looking at the nations as a drop in a bucket. And He's laughing. Ah, you think you're doing a... I mean, come on. I was going to say, come on, man, but that would just be a really bad joke. God is our refuge. Now, having said that, then we see Selah. So let's take that and chew on it for a while and then swallow and then bring it back again. No, enough on that. So now we go to the second one and you'll see why there is a major shift here. A mighty fortress, immovable refuge in the first three verses. Now we come to the concept of God's sovereign presence in the time of turmoil and what we need. Verses 4-7. But, okay, so he finishes up verse 3. And he's just said that we won't fear even though. And he's got these illustrations of the turmoil and the tumultuous events on earth and how bad it is and the swelling and the mountains moving away. There is a river whose streams shall make glad the city of God. Do you see a tad of a shift? You can have that in Hebrew poetry when you have the Selah. And that's one of the purposes for it. We have this idea of whose streams or the divine favors and so forth make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High. And so he brings it down, as it were. Verse 5 is the theological statement. God is in the midst of her. The calmness. The favor. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God shall help her just at the break of dawn. And now we get to this. The nations, they rage. The kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice. The earth melts. Now, there may be some forward projection in the midst of that, but I think that comes on in the next section. As this one, it just simply shows that in the turmoil of this world, where the dwelling place of God is a place of calm, a place of sovereignty, a place of holiness, a place of comfort, a place of rest. There is a river whose streams, some would refer to that they're talking about Jerusalem and the one river going in there. But this one says streams, plural. That's why I think that it's maybe referring to that. But it's talking about the multiple ways of the divine favors that we have peace with God that makes glad the city of God and the place of the dwelling of our refuge, a holy place in the tabernacle of the Most High. That's El Elyon. We have a place of peace. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. The people of God not be moved. God shall help her just at the break of dawn, at the beginning of the day. He will strengthen us. It's a kind of almost a repeat of the first section. But then we get of what's going on outside of the refuge. This is what's going on in where they're for those and those that are in the world that are not in the refuge that is God. The nations rage. YouTube has some interesting YouTubes about this is what the response is going to be by, and then you pick the party, and it's just people screaming and going on, and it's just got all this everything, and there is a sense of a weariness because there's just so much of this, and commercials are doing this, but they're trying to instill fear on either side. If so and so wins, oh, the world's coming to an end. If the other one wins, oh, the world's coming to an end. Well, guess what? This world's not coming to an end until God says it's coming to an end. And that's where we find our rest and trust. No Democrat, no Republican is capable of doing that by themselves or as a group, because God is the one. But the nations will rage. The kingdoms were moved. That's one of the things that I think that we need, that broad sense of a broader picture. The experiment of the Americas and what we did with this republic and these things historically is very young. And historically, we've had an awful lot of kings and queens and monarchs and despots. And there's been far more of them than what we have had the experience of. Now, we've had it really easy. We've been a privileged country. We've been a privileged people to live in this generation. That is not to say that's the way it will always be, because power and authority corrupts, and that is, and mankind in his lost state has always wanted the place of God in his own life. That's really what's on the play here. We want it our way. Our way is the right. I want to make the calls. And that turmoil. But in the midst of it all, the nations rage. The kingdoms are moved. And, you know, democracies can become a place of communism and the like. However, God utters his voice and the earth melts. In other words, you see, that's why when Jesus, or in Martin Luther in his hymn, one little word shall fail him. He uttered his voice, the earth melts. And then we get the Selah, the conclusion of this section. The Lord of hosts, Jehovah Sabaoth, is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Now, why did he do that? Now, there's the Hebrew parallelism. So the Lord Sabaoth is the God of Jacob. But when he uses the Lord Sabaoth, he is the one over the armies. Depending upon context, it refers to the armies, which are the armies of Israel, or the armies, that is, the armies of heaven, which would include the angels. And so we just call it the hosts. But then when it comes on in the second parallelism and says, rather, he's just with us, he is our refuge. God, the God of Jacob, refers to that he is the covenant God. God makes covenant. God has promised the protection of his people. I will never leave you nor forsake you, and other promises that are found there. And we have a God in whom we have refuge based upon his promises. And then Selah. Now he says that. And then this next section, the last section, the third section, we've had a mighty fortress, immovable refuge. Then we've got the sovereign presence of Almighty God through all of this with the promise of peace, stability, and sovereignty. And now this third one is the invincible ruler. Okay? And this is what he says. Come. We have an invitation. Behold. An invitation to view and behold the victory. And this is forward looking. Come. Behold the works of the Lord, who has made desolations in the earth. In other words, he brings judgment. He makes wars cease to the ends of the earth. Well, that's why we know it's future, because that's never really happened. He breaks the bow and cuts the spear in two. He just gets rid of all the armies. you know, for the nation of Israel. Was that not what they were to avoid, finding their strength and their trust in their armies? And he breaks that all. He burns the chariot in the fire. He gets rid of the things that are necessary to maintain peace, because he is the Prince of Peace. And so he is the sovereign one. He says, behold, we not only have the God of peace, but he's also for peace, and he will maintain peace. And then we're given the command. And this is what the psalm is known for. Notice, it's not a suggestion. In light of this, the raging nations, the people complaining, the polarization, wondering what's going to happen. Oh, what if? What if? What if? Well, the what if means nothing, because we have a God who is, there is no if, it is. He is, and he will accomplish his purposes on earth. And then the command. What is the command? People of God, be still. Don't get all, you know, don't get all bound up. Don't become the defeatist, wondering what on earth and what if, you know, this. Be still and know that I am God. He basically is saying, get your emotions under control. Stop being so upset. Calm down. And know, God is God, the perfect wisdom of our God, who takes his grace into the tapestry of our lives. Be still. Calm down and know. Faith gives the soul a view of the great God and his almightiness. Now, brethren, we serve a great God. He isn't, none of this is catching him by surprise. I heard, did you know that there's another scandal that they just accused one of the candidates? It's open today. Did that catch God by surprise? No. Well, technically, did that catch anybody by surprise? Because you know, until the election day, they're going to keep coming up with them. And depending upon who wins, you know, I don't even know if it depends upon who wins. I think no matter who wins, there will be more scandals and more things brought up, and there'll be more fighting. And it's just unbelievable what's going on. But be still and know that God is God. Find your trust on him. Raise your gaze. And then there is in the psalm the declaration. And in this we find great solace. God says, I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. Now, that may not come by Tuesday. That may not come by Friday. But I'm going to second guess that within the next 10,000 years, boy, how's that for target, you know, whittling it down, you know? But in the next 10,000 years, God is going to rectify all of this. And that's one of the things that I think that we need to be mindful of. I am the Lord, and that it is he that will seek revenge. It is he that will bring all this injustice and all the lies, and he will correct it all in his timing for his glory. And all of this gunk, I don't even know how to spell that, G-U-N-G, I don't know, but you know, all this gunk and yuckiness of all of the things that are in this world, God's going to correct it. But he doesn't do it on the day of election necessarily. He does it in his own time. And he will be exalted. He will be exalted in the nations and be exalted in the earth. Now, having said that, and then given us that salve of the soul for us to be able to calm down and then to realize God is God, he's the one in control. Then we have the final declaration in his declaration of glory. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. My brethren, God is with us. We serve the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. We have the promise of eternal life. And we are citizens of a kingdom far greater than the United States of America. Now, that doesn't mean we don't vote and we don't do things like that. But what it does mean is don't let the cares of this world so cloud your vision of our great God and what He is doing in this earth, which will eventually be judged, and we will rejoice as righteousness reigns. My brethren, our God is still on the throne, and He's the one who reigns. Would you stand with me tonight as we close?